thank you for coming, and thank you for inviting me. It's a nice opportunity to dig into something that you don't often get the chance to have a look at, although, as I'll explain later, I have done some work on this a few years ago. If you've got Bibles, then we will read, and we will read Ecclesiastes chapter 1. And I've no idea what the page number is on your, in your Bibles. 668. Now, I don't want you to give up in despair by the time I finish the Bible reading, because it will get much worse as I go on. But my method of reading this chapter is purposeful and deliberate. I am usually a more cheerful reader than I will be tonight, but you will see why as we get on. Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Entitled in the NIV, Everything is Meaningless. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome. More than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already. Long ago, it was here before our time. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I've seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, look, I've increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. And then I applied myself to to understanding of wisdom. And also of madness and folly. But I learn that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. Well, thank goodness that's over. I think it would be fair to say that the book we call Ecclesiastes is the most miserable book in the whole Bible. The catchphrase, which is found 13 times in the first two chapters alone and 34 times in the whole 12 chapters, sums up the message and the tone of the book. Meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Although those of you who are brought up on the Authorized Version or the RSV might prefer what I prefer, which is vanity of vanities, all is vanity. The Hebrew word there for vanity, meaningless, is hebel, which can be translated as vapor or breath, but is used figuratively here for that which is insubstantial, that which vanishes, that which doesn't last. And the writer, who is sometimes called Koheleth, that's with a Q, Q-O-H-E-L-E-T-H, which is the Hebrew word for teacher, that's the words of the teacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem, the writer, sometimes called Koheleth, comes to the conclusion that everything you can think of is all a bit pointless, really. It's all a waste of time when you think about it. So, chapter 1, verse 12, following, wisdom is meaningless. Chapter 2, pleasures are meaningless. Chapter 2, 17, following, toil and hard work are meaningless. Chapter 4, advancement is meaningless. Chapter 5, riches are meaningless. And so on, and so on, and so on. And he adopts this very pessimistic, very gloomy, very cynical view of life. And he coins some of those absolutely amazing phrases that have come down through the mists of time and that we have absorbed into our sort of everyday language. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. That's his sort of tone. That's his attitude to it all. And in addition to this hymn to misery, one of the other great themes in Ecclesiastes is what we would call the breakdown of justice. He points out that the righteous often die young, the wicked often get away scot-free, those who commit themselves to doing what is right often get no recognition or reward, and scoundrels live a life of luxury. If you want to turn to chapter 4, this is what he has to say on this theme of the breakdown of justice. Chapter 4. Again, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. How cheerful is that? But better than both is the one who has never been born, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. So that there are some writers, and James Crenshaw is one of them, who thinks that what we have in Ecclesiastes here is an example of a crisis of faith that is at the heart of the Israeli Jewish community, that they have had so many things gone wrong, they're faced with so many disasters, that their simple faith has been shattered and challenged in so many directions, and therefore Ecclesiastes is a product of this crisis of intellectual faith that the people of Israel have gone through. Well, be that as it may, Ecclesiastes found its way into our Bibles, and perhaps it found its way into our Bibles because of its association with Solomon. In verse 1, the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem, repeated again in verse 12, I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. So it was this believed link to Solomon that gave the work its credentials, and therefore it came into the Holy Scriptures as a result of that connection. Even though its message, its tone, seems to be quite out of kilter with so much else that we find in Old and certainly in New Testament as well. And so depressing is the overall theme of Ecclesiastes that the faithful believing community have, from the outset, done their level best to try and cheer it up. And to give it a bit of a spin, to give it a bit of a gloss, to help it say something a little bit more hopeful and optimistic. So, for example, if you were to turn right to the end of the chapter, the letter, chapter 12, you'll find there verses 13 and 14 say this. Chapter 12, verse 13. Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. So somebody, probably an editor of the original work of Ecclesiastes, when the final form of Ecclesiastes was being put together, some editor has come along at the end and thought, gosh, we can't let this sit on its own. We've got to give it a little bit more of a message. We've got to give it a little bit more of a something. And so he introduces there themes which aren't in the book at all. Fear God, keep his commandments. There's nothing in Ecclesiastes about keeping the commandments. This is the duty of all mankind. God will bring every deed into judgment. So somebody found the message of Ecclesiastes so difficult to swallow that there at the end there is a little codicil added which has tried to give it a religious message that it doesn't have in the earlier part of the book. The other way in which Ecclesiastes was helped, if I can use that phrase. Do you remember when we, if you were here when we did Song of Songs, I mentioned to you this wonderful thing called the Targums. Okay? The Targums were Aramaic translations of the Old Testament, but they came with a commentary. And they were written about the 7th or 8th century AD, so hundreds of years after the Old Testament was written, these Aramaic versions came out. And they don't just translate, they interpret. So when it came to Song of Songs, instead of this love song between a man and a woman, you get this history of Israel being mapped out in the Targum of Song of Songs. Well, there's a Targum of Ecclesiastes, or a Targum of Koheleth, as it's referred to. And it's an absolute gem. That's my version of it there. It's the Targums of Job, Proverbs and Koheleth. So if you want to have a look at it afterwards, you can have a look at it. But don't run off with it, because it cost me an arm and a leg. So this, for example, is what Ecclesiastes chapter 1 verse 3 says in our versions. What do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? That's what chapter 1 verse 3 says. Now, this is what the Targum of chapter 1 verse 3 says. What profit does a man have after he dies from all his labour which he labours under the sun in this world, unless he occupies himself with the study of the law of Moses in order to receive a complete reward in the world to come before the master of the world? Chapter 2, verse 11, says, yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind, nothing was gained under the sun. The Targum of Ecclesiastes has that, and then it goes on to say, except that I have a complete reward for my good deeds in the world to come. The writer of Ecclesiastes, now you need to understand this to have any sense, to make any sense of this book at all, you have to understand that when this was written 300 years or so before Jesus, the writer had no belief in life after death. The writer of this book, when he pens it, did not have any understanding that there was a life beyond this life. It wasn't there in the psyche of Israel. The writers of the Old Testament had no conception of life beyond this life. That was the case when this was originally written. But by the 8th century AD, the Jewish community had got a belief in the afterlife, just as the Christian belief in the afterlife had developed. And therefore, the Targum is able to cheer the book up enormously. So he's able to bring a whole new dimension into this that wasn't there originally. So he's able to say, well, yes, life is meaningless in this world, but in the world to come it will be an awful lot better, provided that you live by the law of Moses. That's what the Targum is trying to say. He's trying to reinterpret the message for a different worldview and for a different audience. Chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, Koheleth, Ecclesiastes, point out that the rich don't get to enjoy the fruit of their wealth. The Targum of Ecclesiastes says that they don't get to enjoy the fruit of their wealth because of the rich man's sin. So he brings a message in there about sin and obedience and righteousness and goodness that, again, isn't there in the original. So that a message in Ecclesiastes that was clearly bound by the limits of this world and this life is taken by the Targum into a completely different message, which has a belief and an understanding in life after this life. And for most of the Christian era, something of the similar process has happened as well. Most Christian preachers over the centuries have adopted one simple approach to the book of Ecclesiastes. They've looked at it, they've read it, life is meaningless, and the Christian preachers have said, yes, life is meaningless without God. But if you've got God in your life, then life is full of meaning and full of significance, and you will be all well. In other words, the gospel preachers have taken Ecclesiastes as we have it. They've taken it as part one, and then they've added part two. They've taken this as the bad news as a springboard to the good news. They've said, yes, all that Ecclesiastes says is perfectly true. The world is meaningless. The world is bad. Everything is sad. Everything is miserable. Everything is tragic. However, come to faith in Christ and it'll all change and it'll all be transformed and everything in the garden will be wonderful. I'm being a little facetious perhaps, but basically, broadly speaking, that has been the method in which Christian preachers have taken the book of Ecclesiastes. They've taken it at face value. They've said everything is miserable, but come to faith in Christ and it will all be different. Now, that is a perfectly plausible methodology. It's a perfectly plausible way of dealing with the text. But it's not my way of dealing with the text. And what I want to do tonight is I want to look at Ecclesiastes as it is. I want us to look at the book as it is and say to you that the writer, as he pens this, is wanting to say something important, wanting to say something significant, but understanding that he has a limited worldview. He has a limited understanding of life. He believes that life is bound solely and simply by the years we live on this earth. He has no conception of life beyond this life. And therefore, what he has to say has to be understood in that context. And if we understand that, and we understand the limitations with which he's writing, then I actually believe you can get something positive out of it. I know you'll find that hard at the minute, but I'll get there. There is something positive and purposeful and helpful that he's got to say. We don't have to Christianize it. We don't have to set it in a worldview that it didn't have. We can listen to it as it is and still find something helpful and meaningful in it. What I believe that the writer of Ecclesiastes really can help us with is to understand what it is to be human. What it is to be human. And what he's very helpful at doing is explaining to us that we as human beings have limits and have limitations. There are boundaries to what we can do within the phrase in Ecclesiastes, the few short years that we have under the sun, or God has given us under the sun. There are boundaries to what we can do, but if we understand those boundaries, it can actually give us something meaningful to grasp hold of. Some years ago, I read an article in a Old Testament journal, and it was called Koheleth, Preacher of Joy. Well, my ears pricked up, or my eyes pricked up when I saw that, and I've written down here 3, 4, 5, 6 joyful verses in Ecclesiastes. Let me just read some of them to you. You might not think they're that joyful, but anyway. So, chapter 2, verse 24. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too I see is from the hand of God. Chapter 2, verse 24, that is. Chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. I know that there is nothing better for men than to be happy and do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is the gift of God. Chapter 3, verse 22. So I saw that there is nothing better for a man than to enjoy his work, because that is his lot. Chapter 8, verse 15. So I commend the enjoyment of life, because nothing is better for a man under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany him in his work all the days of the life God has given him under the sun. And chapter 9, verse 9, enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days. This is the gift of God. This is from the hand of God. Life is limited, he's wanting to say. Life has a span of years. And his advice is not to despair, not to give up. His advice is to recognize these boundaries, but to see them all as gifts from God. To see them as something that God has blessed us with, provided for us, and to enjoy it while we can. So that work, leisure, eating, drinking, reading, learning, studying, enjoy the wife of your love. All these things are valid things in and of themselves, and are things that are to be cherished, to be enjoyed. And if we accept the boundaries of life, then these things can still give us meaning and can still give us purpose. Ultimately, it's the way we approach these things that is key. If we take that simple task that we do, if we take that simple thing that we do in our lives, if we see it as a gift from God, if we see it as something that we can do and take pleasure and satisfaction in, it will give us meaning. But if we see it as meaningless, if we see it as a waste of time, then in fact it will be meaningless and a waste of time. It's about the attitude that we approach things with. So that Ecclesiastes here in his book is simply setting out for us, simply mapping out for us the boundaries that all of us have. And if we understand those boundaries, and one of the main boundaries, of course, is death. One day we all pop our clogs. If we understand those boundaries and those limitations, then actually we can still grasp meaning, we can still grasp satisfaction and achievement from this life, even though there are limitations and even though there are boundaries. Let me push this a little bit further to try and make it a bit clearer what I'm trying to say. Back in 2005, I did a series of sermons in my last church on the book of Ecclesiastes. I think I did about 7 altogether. And I tried to be ever so clever, and I used alliteration. So the first of the talks that I gave, I entitled "The Meaningfulness of Meaninglessness." You see? Clever, wasn't it? The meaningfulness of meaninglessness. And it was simply trying to point out this thing here that Ecclesiastes is saying. These boundaries, these limits to life. If we understand the boundaries that we have, then we can still carve out meaning and purpose and satisfaction in those days that God has given us under the sun. That was the first of the talks I gave, the meaningfulness of meaninglessness. That week 3, I'll come back to week 2 in a minute, week 3 was the fallacy of fame. The fallacy of fame. So, many of us are driven people. We want to get on. We want to achieve. We want to succeed. We want to climb the greasy pole. We want to get to the top. And sometimes in order to get to the top, we cut a few corners. Sometimes in order to get to the top, we tread on a few toes. We hurt a few people. We may lose one or two friends. We may jeopardize our marriage because we're at work so long that things are going wrong at home. But hey, we want to get on. We want to succeed. We want to achieve things. And guess what? We get there. Terrific, we get there, we get to the top job. And then we retire. And somebody else takes over. And they give us a watch. Thank you very much. No watches. All right, okay. And who remembers us? Nobody remembers us. We're just a nothing. We've spent all that time and all that energy and all that effort. And when we get there, it wasn't worth it anyway. And who remembers? It was, you know, there's as much satisfaction in the lady making the tea in the office as the man who's running the board. That's what Ecclesiastes is trying to expose here. The fallacy of fame. The nonsense that we try to make a name for ourselves when in actual fact, there are these limits, these boundaries that make a nonsense of life if we invest too seriously in it. That's what he's trying to expose here. The nonsense that comes when we drive and strive ourselves to achieve, and when we get there, it was all a flipping waste of time. That's what he's trying to say. The fourth sermon in the series I did in 2005 was The Mirage of Money. More alliteration. Picking up this time, Ecclesiastes 5:10. Whoever loves money never has enough money. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. Here's a scenario. You've won £10,000. And you are so pleased. Marvellous. You've won £10,000. It's a shame it wasn't £100,000, because if it was £100,000, I could have done this, this, or this. Actually, it was a shame it wasn't £500,000, because if it was £500,000, I could have bought a house, and I could have done this, this, and this. Well, actually, maybe if it had been £1,000,000, that would have been more useful, because then I could have done this, and I could have given this to them, and I could have helped them, and whoever loves money never has enough money. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. What Ecclesiastes points out here is that we are always dissatisfied. We are always dissatisfied. Let's say you get a nice new house and it's got 5 bedrooms and it's got wonderful things there and you say to yourself, oh, it's a shame it doesn't have a swimming pool. And then say, let's have it has a swimming pool. And then you say to yourself, well, it's a shame it doesn't have a paddock and it doesn't have a pony or a field at the back. You're never satisfied. Doesn't matter how much you have, you always want a little bit more. There's always something wrong with it. That's the mirage of money. It looks attractive. It looks concrete. It looks real. But the more you get closer to it, the more it disappears into a nothingness. And that thing which you have craved, that thing that you thought would make you so happy and so fulfilled, has actually left you just as miserable as you were when you were penniless. The mirage of money. But my favourite sermon in this series back in 2005, I lost the alliteration. I couldn't get there. I called it The Illusion of Perfection. The Illusion of Perfection. And I tried to point out how many of us are driven by a mythical belief in perfection. Indeed, the whole marketing industry, it seems to me, is based on an attempt to con us into believing that there is this thing called perfection. Look at the adverts on the television. There was one the other day I noticed. It was advertising holidays. I won't say the name of the holiday company. Book now with blank, 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 blank for the most perfect holiday ever. And there's this picture of these, it's beautiful sunshine, obviously. And they're these happy children who are running, smiling cheerfully towards this swimming pool. And they're leaping into the air and they're splashing into the water and they're having a whale of a time. And their parents are behind, equally smiling, equally chilled and relaxed with beautiful white teeth. Have you noticed they always have beautiful white teeth? The most perfect holiday ever. That bears no relations to the holidays I used to have with the kids. I used to be so exhausted by the time I went on holiday that I was a bag of misery. I am at the best of times, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. I was just so thoroughly antisocial. I didn't want to mix with anybody. I didn't want to do anything. And the children, these happy, smiling children on the TV screen. This is boring. The water's too cold. The sun's too hot. The TV's in French. Of course it's in French. You're in France. Can we go home now? For the most perfect holiday ever. What an illusion. And then what about Christmas on the television? It's December. The adverts. Come to Sainsbury's for your most perfect Christmas ever. And there it is, this long table with a massive great big turkey in the middle, all brown and golden and everything. And there's plates all around it with the beautiful vegetables there and the potatoes. And again, they're all sitting round there smiling. And there's Mum at the head of the table and she's beaming all over her face. Who is she? She's not the woman who made it. She's the actress that they brought in to put there. The woman who made all that is absolutely pasted. She's worn out to a frazzle. She's exhausted. She's a wreck. And those smiling people all around the table there, that doesn't bear relation to reality, does it? Uncle Cyril's come and he's had too much to drink again. The potatoes are overcooked, the turkey's dry. Your son brings his girlfriend and she turned out to be vegetarian and you didn't know. The most perfect Christmas ever. There's no such thing. It's a marketing trick, but we buy into it. We think it can happen. We think it can be real and it never can be real. And do you know who knew that? Ecclesiastes, Koheleth, the teacher, he knew that. He knew that everything is imperfect. He knew that everything is flawed because that's just the way it is. And what about that other thing that you see again on the television so often, the perfect wedding? Yeah, the perfect wedding. And there they all are, this beautiful slim bride. Why are they always slim? But anyway, this beautiful slim bride on this beautiful gorgeous day, and they're all beaming and happy and everything is going so wonderfully well. It was so cold when we got married that the photographs at our wedding, my wife's nose is red. That's the reality so often of what these things are. Imperfect. Imperfect. And it would be funny. It would be funny if it wasn't for the fact that we buy into these illusions. That we buy into this illusion of perfection. And sometimes it can... I've known people, for example, whose whole marriage has been ruined by the fact that their wedding day did not turn out to be as perfect as they had thought it was going to be. And they thought that Bob and Sis's wedding was perfect, and it probably wasn't, and it almost certainly wasn't. But compared to their wedding, this couple's wedding wasn't anything like as that. And the wife is disappointed, and there is this cloud that hangs over her marriage because it was so disappointing that the wedding didn't live up to her expectations. The illusion of perfection. Koheleth, Ecclesiastes, points out to us some of the absurdities of life. The limitations of this life. Things go wrong. Things spoil. Accept it. It's part of life. Get real, get over it. And rather than becoming miserable or frustrated or disappointed when things go wrong, just accept it. And find enjoyment, find contentment and satisfaction within the limitations of your imperfect holiday, or your imperfect Christmas, or your imperfect wedding, or your imperfect job, or your imperfect family, or your imperfect church. Koheleth, Ecclesiastes, does have a belief in God. He clearly has a belief in God. He doesn't reject God, but what he does reject are simplistic notions about God. He understands the rigors of life. He understands the things that can go wrong, even in the most loyal and faithful of believers. He knows that full well. He sees that there is randomness, that there is a haphazard nature to life and the world. Things do tragically, sadly go wrong. But what he asks of us is to make the most of what we do have. To make the most of what we do have. To treat this life with all its limitations as a gift. He urges us to treasure it, to celebrate it, to grasp it with both hands, and take delight and pleasure from the simple and good things during the few days of life God has given us on this earth. Let's accept the limits and the boundaries that there are in our being human. And if we accept those boundaries, then we can find meaning, satisfaction, joy in those things God has given us to do in the years that we've got. And that can give us real purpose and real achievement in what we can do. I have done my best.